So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Reviews Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
And today, we will be diving into our final thoughts on the new MacBook Pros, the Pixel 6, the Facebook Papers with Carissa Bell, who's going to be joining us in a bit, all the major news. If you're digging the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes, because that actually matters the most, and drop us a line at podcast@engadget.com. We also live stream typically on Thursdays around 10 a.m. Eastern, so check us out on the Engadget YouTube page there. And before we get to all that news, I just want to say this is a special episode. 100 Woo-hoo! Episodes!
Woo-hoo!
Wow!
100 years old. No, not that was the wrong thing. I should. Yeah.
But 100 episodes. That's pretty good. We don't normally see podcasts get that far. So congrats, Sherlyn and Ben and everybody who's helped
congrats
make this possible.
Yeah, of course.
Hey, we made it. It's hard to congratulate yourself. I'm not Matthew McConaughey at the Oscars. Okay. So the people listening to us now on the live stream and watching us, let's start with a Q&A. Let's do a special audience Q&A to kick things off. And there are so many things people want to dive into, so Ben is going to collect some questions from people. But one question I just saw as we were kicking off the episode is Chiming Chung in the chat room asks, what is gaming like on the new MacBook Pros? And these are the ones with the M1 Pro and M1 Max chips from Apple. And all I have to say is what gaming? It's Max. I spent $20 to buy Borderlands 3, which is one of the few like recent games and recent within the past couple of years that can actually run, like actually runs on a Mac. And even on the M1 Max, the fastest chip, it ran like crap, right? Because that thing is being emulated from Intel over to, you know, the ARM architecture that the M1 chips are based on. It was like 15 to 20 FPS, you know, like you can't play a game like that. This hardware is clearly powerful, as we'll talk about, but Apple also has to encourage developers to start like making games that aren't just ports of all their iOS games. Sure, all the Apple Arcade games work fine because that's what they're made for. They actually worked fine on the MacBook Air as well, so they don't need the most demanding hardware around, and they look pretty good on these computers. But if you want to play Steam games or, you know, big things, Fortnite still doesn't work because of their ongoing legal battles with Apple. All those things will not exist on a Mac. So maybe go PC if you want to do some light gaming at all.
Some more general thoughts before we kick off the rest of the show. Chris Velasco in the chat is all like, happy 100, y'all. And I,
yay,
you know, don't know who that stranger is, but thank you.
Don't know.
And another good general thought from Declan Flynn in the chat. What one tech idea over the last 100 episodes are we surprised did not take off? Yeah, that's a really, really good question, Declan.
I'm
more
anything,
surprised things yeah. did take off. It's more like, oh, I think we're more skeptical than we are optimistic, maybe, on this show.
I think between like episode 1, 2, and 3 and now 100, I think it's kind of surprising how well foldables have come along.
Sure. Yeah.
Because right around when we started, foldables had just started, and we were like, like, this is gross. Why would anyone pay to beta a device? And now they're actually becoming a little more viable.
I still think they're gross. I still think they're too expensive, but, you know, yeah, sure.
I feel like that's a pretty typical evolution path for most new types of technology, though. I
for
think
sure, for sure.
Another thing that hasn't really taken off, though, is like rollable TVs still aren't mainstream.
That's never going to happen. Absolutely never going to happen. Yeah, I've seen those things in person.
Yeah,
yeah, we've seen the pricing from LG. It was like what, 50,000 to 100,000. Nobody needs that stuff. So
also, it's fine. Declan, the last 100 episodes is kind of a short time frame. Actually, if you give me a little further back, I can tell you like flexible batteries are something I wish had taken off, but they never really did. Graphene's been talked about forever, and like, where are we on that?
Yeah,
and then I thought QLED will be in everything, every laptop by now, not TVs. They're pretty, I think, much more common now than before, but
there are a lot of computers with quantum dot displays, but certainly mini LED has become the like thing the go-to, which is fine because that's actually, it solves the bigger problem with LCDs, which is backlighting, whereas QLED was just like, here are quantum dots in your display to make colors look a little better. Like that was always a little bit of a marketing hype. Do want to say, like, when it comes to foldables, you know, they're getting better, but the real reason we were so hard on Samsung at the beginning was because they had no idea what they were doing. They were clearly paying, like making people pay to be beta testers for like a first gen product that was any other company would have.
You can say that of the original Surface Duo as well, to be honest. You can say that of a lot of things is what I'm saying. Like Lenovo's dual screen yoga tablet was something like that.
But the thing is, like, there are bad products and then there are things that just are broken, right? The original Galaxy Fold.
Yeah, the original Galaxy Fold certainly, like, when people were peeling off the screen protectors and dust was getting in the hinges, that sort of thing was pretty embarrassing for them. But, like, there's also a lot of crap gadgets out there, like the Lenovo ThinkPad X1 Fold, the original Duo, and the new Duo.
The hardware in those things, at least, like, I think for the most part, worked, right? You reviewed the Duo. The issue was the software, right?
So, the Surface Duo's hardware was really nice. But, I mean, again, the thing is that I don't want to defend Samsung too much because, like, it was an expensive, like, experiment. But I feel like we use that same headline on a lot of things, right? Expensive experiment. I've seen a lot of our reviews go up like that because
we can certainly fight about that.
I don't really want to fight about that anymore.
I would say like more than any other device in any recent memory. I don't think we've seen that. And that was coming right off the Galaxy Note 7 exploding batteries. I guess I've reviewed a lot of different things
that have done that. That's probably why. Yeah.
You've reviewed a lot of Android devices. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I have a couple of banked questions. One of them is from Gijo Augustin, who asks, is the iPhone Performance Core and the M1 and M1 Max Core, are they the same or are they different?
It looks like they're different. They're all based on like the same architecture that Apple has been kind of building up. But the M1 chips, the way they're actually designed, basically they're bigger. They can fit in more powerful cores, but also more GPU cores than the A-series chips. I haven't done like deep architecture dives into them, but it's basically like the upgrade you'd expect to power bigger screens and things like laptops. So whatever innovations Apple makes on the A series front could easily make their way over to the M chips. So yeah, they're all kind of related in that way.
Okay, Charlene, you go.
No, I just, you know, saw a bunch of questions relating to Pixel 6 that I wanted to say we'll get to in a little bit.
Yes, but I think you mentioned Josh Sachdeva, and they had another question that I thought was interesting, which is, how can Sony make a hard comeback? Do you think they're even trying?
They can't.
I really love their tech in phones, but their marketing is really disappointing. What do you think about that?
I wrote a whole piece about that last year, where
I forget the title,
but it was like, can Sony ever win back its, you know, consumer electronics crown? I don't really think it can, just because at right now, Sony is a company that is majority being successful because of the PlayStation and because of Sony Pictures. So they still have the Spider-Man stuff. PlayStation is the thing that's still making money for Sony. Everything else is kind of gravy. And they also do weird things like those neckband speakers, which I reviewed the first one. One of the more recent ones that they released, it seems like it's gotten better over time. Nobody needs neckband speakers. And certainly nobody needs neckband speakers that require a breakout box that you have to plug in like audio connections into because it doesn't have Bluetooth. What are you doing? It's a lot of stuff like that where Sony's a very old Japanese company, and they move slowly. They don't innovate as much anymore. Apple pretty much killed them as a consumer electronics company. So it's really all they have is PlayStation. That's all they have. Maybe at some point they'll be able to like do something else. They used to talk to me, you know, about products and stuff. And then I wrote that piece because it was their, I believe, their 50th anniversary. But it was a major 75th. It was a major like anniversary for them. And Sony just didn't want to talk to anybody. They had no news. They had nothing to say because they weren't doing anything, you know? So the most successful thing they've done recently is the PlayStation 5. And it's been super successful on the gaming front. But they still can't make enough. You know, I don't think a game console can keep a whole company alive. Do you guys have any other thoughts? Sherlyn, like, I don't know if you have any Sony love from back in the day.
I don't know if Josh Akdeva's question is like specifically pertaining to their phone business or like every other aspect that you were talking about. The phone business is where I'm a bit more familiar, right? With the Xperia phones, they tend to be like super expensive, but they have very good display and camera tech.
They failed in phones.
Yeah, they did. If only because they I don't know what they did wrong there. I can't even tell you because like they did what people generally do, which is go ham on their expertise areas, which is for Sony cameras and displays. Yeah, why not? But I guess they just have too strong a competitor in Samsung. Also, Sony makes the sensors for every smartphone up there.
Sony makes the sensors for everybody. But here's the thing. Like, I don't know if you were paying attention to phones in like the early 2000s, Sherlyn, but like the Sony Ericsson stuff pre-iPhone was like the shit, right? That was the like really cool feature phones that you wanted. I had one. I had a candy bar one. And those were like they had such cool tech, and they looked really cool too. They were designed very well. Sony had such a great lead in like mobile tech. And then the iPhone dropped and Sony was just like, I don't know what's happening. It took them a while to like reassess and go Android. And even though they work in the components level, they produce the camera sensors and everything. They could never quite make the package because the iPhone was just like such a huge leap ahead of what they were doing. And even other companies could kind of come in and start building things that are just so much far ahead of whatever Sony could think of. So I'm thinking of like HTC, when they started making like cool Android phones, you know, they were the first LTE. The Thunderbolt was the first LTE phone in the US, I believe, or one of the first. And then you get to like the HTC One, which we love so much. And you see like the culmination of smartphone design there, ideas that Apple and other companies eventually took. Sony was just like, we got cameras. We got screens, you know?
Those are for their phones. But then, like you pointed out, and some people in the chat are rightly pointing out as well, like, other aspects of Sony's business do really well, right? PlayStation, the wireless headphones, the audio stuff, really they do really well.
It's
really
just PlayStation, yeah.
It's mostly I'm talking PlayStation, about like, but their headphones are great.
I'm talking about, like, big business, right? I'm talking about, like, a thing you look at and be like, oh, yeah, that's a Sony product. I want that. Whereas Apple has killed them.
I had a Sony TV. Holy shit. I mean, it was given to me.
It was given
secondhand.
To you. They
Not that
failed
I made the
in the TV.
To
like, go read that piece, everybody. Dun,
dun, dun, dun. So in the comments, Kenny Ong mentioned like Sony phones with the Sony operating system came with a lot of bloatware, yep. Which was absolutely true.
That was, yeah, mm-hmm. They didn't know what was up. So that piece, by the way, was called Can Sony Reclaim Its Former Glory? And you can find pretty much all of my arguments there. Like, you bring up TVs, Sherlyn. Do you know what happened in the 90s? In the 90s,
I don't know. Sony... I'm not stuck in the past, I guess.
I just got to say, learn. Y'all need to learn your history, especially for a company as old as Sony, because they own the CRT world. The Trinitron screens were like the top of the world for a while. And then LCDs started coming out. And Sony was like, no. We can just ignore flat screens. We've got CRTs. And then they basically lagged behind on all that stuff for the past, like, for a long time. They never quite recovered from that. So, hey, Sony's in a lot of trouble. Go read my piece and let us know what you think Sony could do to kind of like come back. I don't know if it can. Not in the way that it could like overtake Apple or Samsung or anybody.
And we are going to be talking at least quickly about the Sony Xperia a little bit later in this episode. Did get a review unit, and I think it was Matt Smith.
That's a different phone. That's a different phone. Matt's reviews of the One Mark III, and people are talking about the new one that was announced this week.
That is my fault then.
Okay. That's also their fault for bad naming. So they can't name
it's
anything.
Very bad naming. I hate the Xperia One Mark III. Mm-hmm. Like what? And then if you write them out the Roman numerals way, it's like one I. Like okay, cool.
Their cameras are like A7R series 3. Yeah.
Oh my god.
I could see the pain in Sherlyn's face when I got it wrong.
Yeah. I'm not a total hater. I love go read my review of the 1000 XM3s. They own certain markets really well.
Wireless
Sony
audio. That's what we just said. Yeah. And the cameras are pretty fucking good.
The cameras are pretty good. They don't like own the market is the thing, right? Like they're not.
They effectively pushed Samsung out of that market. Samsung was trying to make like mirrorless things happen for a while, and then they make smaller and tinier pancake lenses and cameras. I know.
Samsung tries to do everything.
A moment.
Yeah.
And then died.
It was a couple of years. I did buy the Sony A7C, which is like kind of a miracle of a camera because it's really compact. It's a full frame sensor. So like some of that stuff is certainly incredible, but that's for weird nerds, you know, and photography professionals. It's not products everybody's going to buy. But do we have any other questions and we can move on?
I mean, we have a ton of other questions, but I think we should move on because people are asking about things we might be talking about. We will be talking about later, like the fragmentation of Android 12L. That is on our list. It's coming. I know DaVinci would love
to
talk about
that. Can we just put it like audio of me laughing for 5 minutes as we talk about Android 12L? Yeah. Okay, thank you all so much for your questions. And you know what? I love doing Q&As. I love doing live Q&As. So I hope to we can make more time for this for future episodes. As always, you can shoot us your questions at podcast@engadget.com. Let's move on to our MacBook Pro reviews, which are the things that I think people just can't stop talking about. Once certain people knew I was reviewing these things, I just got a lot of text. I got a lot of DMs about what's up with these computers? Are they good? Are they really worth the price and everything? And TLDR, I think they are. I think they're fantastic. This is the new 14-inch MacBook Pro with the M1 Pro and Max chips. You can kind of upgrade them either way. And the brand new 16-inch redesign of the MacBook Pro. These computers are great. Everybody, I don't know what else to say. If you want a powerhouse machine, if you want a machine that has the power of a Mac Pro or a high-end desktop from a couple years ago, these things will floor you. My benchmark scores were kind of off the charts. They blew away all the Geekbench 5 scores I had this year from all of the laptops we tested. And that includes the Intel Nook 11 Extreme, which is a mini desktop running a desktop chip. That shouldn't be happening with with chips in vaguely portable laptops. I think they have gotten heavier in a certain way. The 14-inch is 3.5 pounds, and the 16-inch is 4.7 to 4.8, depending on the chip you chose. And before, the last 16-inch model was I think around 4.2 or 4.3. So these are bigger, these are thicker, they're chunkier. They remind me a lot of the PowerBooks, as I mentioned last week, kind of the old school design from Apple, but it's kind of everything. They're so fast. The screens are beautiful. It's the Apple Retina XDR screens, so they support HDR. They have very, very high peak brightness. They're beautiful looking screens. They all have mini LED backlights. So you get almost an OLED-like experience from watching these. You don't get to see the stuff in a normal backlight. You don't see that banding you do on cheap LCD monitors. They're good. They're perfect. They're just really, really expensive. The 14-inch starts at $2,000. The 16-inch starts at $2,500. And that's kind of it, right? I don't think they're replacing the 13-inch. They're certainly not replacing the 13-inch with the 14-inch. That earlier model is still available for $1,299. It's a lot slower. It doesn't have these new chips. It doesn't have all the new ports and stuff. And the screen is worse. So that's the thing. I really wonder what they're going to do with the 13-inch down the line. Because I didn't find that one to be a huge update over the MacBook Air M1. But I guess we'll see. Yeah. Do you guys have any questions? Sherlyn, what do you think? Are you intrigued by these?
Do you think it's worth the price difference? The huge jump in price that we were discussing in earlier episodes?
So this is the main thing. It's not really a huge jump in price. Because the MacBook Pro 13-inch is still around. It is. Yes. It still exists. There was never, yes, a 14-inch before. The 16-inch has only increased by $100. So the 16-inch was always a really expensive computer. Yeah.
I guess what I meant to say was, is it worth the price difference from the 13-inch to the 14? Like, should I get, let's say I'm looking at two of them, the 13 and the 14.
Yeah.
Is that $700, dollar difference?
Do you edit like a ton of video? Do you live and swim in 4K?
I mean, personally, I don't. But let's say I do. Yeah. Then you think it's worth it, right? So if I edit a lot of video, I shouldn't go for the 13-inch?
I think, go read my review of the 13-inch, everybody. It's a fine computer, but that ran the last year's M1 chip. It wasn't faster than the MacBook Air at all in my benchmarks. The only real good thing is that one has a fan and the MacBook Air is completely passive. But if you want to do actual work, if you want to sit and push out videos, do 3D rendering, do a lot of serious production work, these are the computers you need to buy. And at that point, then that price is actually kind of within reason. The closest PC competitor to the MacBook Pro 14-inch is probably the Razer Blade 14-inch, which I reviewed a couple months ago. That thing starts at $1,800. So for this level of hardware and everything, you're paying a lot of money to begin with. They're within the spec of what people pay.
Yeah, it seems more along the lines of what we're seeing from companies like Acer and Asus when they're targeting so-called creators with their creator series, Acer's Concept D series. Yeah. Asus has the Studio, the Pro Studio series.
The Pro Studio, yeah.
I think, I can't remember what HP and Dell call theirs. I don't know if they're making such high-end.
So for Dell, too, I just reviewed the XPS 15, which I think is a good PC competitor to the 16-inch MacBook Pro. And sure, to begin with, the Dell is cheaper, I think, for an Intel i7 chip, maybe comparable amounts of RAM storage. The XPS 15 is $500 less than the MacBook Pro 16-inch. But once you start bumping up that CPU, because you want a CPU that's kind of giving you the power that you would get from the MacBook Pro 16-inch, then the Dell becomes more and more expensive. Then it creeps up towards $2,300, $2,400. I think there's a lot of sticker shock around these things, but if you're in the market for this hardware, if you actually need this stuff for real work, these are the prices you're going to be paying. It's tough out there, but these computers will last you a while. They're rock solid from what I've seen. Yeah.
That's great. I remember you were saying that there was some questions from the chat earlier about gaming, and you already talked about that, but is there anything else you want to point it out? How's the camera notch? I a lot of people
camera's
are asking
good
about that.
The notch, check out my review, everybody. I addressed all of this too, and we have a video review up on YouTube on our channel. The notch, I think, is not a big deal. You see it in photos and you're like, I don't want that ugly thing at the top of my screen. But the notch, if you've ever used a Mac before, the notch sits where the menu bar is. So that's an area of the screen you never touch unless you're dealing with the file or edit menu or something like that. The notch is right up there. The notch completely disappears when you full screen certain apps, which is that's nice. It just kind of hides the menu too. So you could just also just add a black or a really dark wallpaper, and that just kind of hides the visibility of the notch. I don't mind it just because you still have a lot of screen real estate below it. You never use that space up top. And it's a much better camera. It's a 1080p camera. So we've been asking for this for a while. Yeah.
Should you buy this over a Mac, like a desktop Mac?
There are no good desktop Macs now. So yes.
it seems like it, right? Yeah.
They're waiting. I think everybody's waiting to see. They expected to see a Mac Mini with the M1 Pro and the M1 Max, and maybe we'll see something like that. Or maybe they're waiting till next year at some point to give us a refreshed MacBook Air. That one is still running the M1 chip. And maybe we'll get Mac Mini along that. And we're still waiting for whatever the redesigned Mac Pro will be. Who knows? But expect faster chips down the line.
At this point, what Apple laptops still use Intel chips? Are there any left?
I have to go look at the things. You can still, I believe you could still buy. No, you can't buy the 15-inch anymore. And no, you can't buy the older 16-inch too. So
they're all gone, right? Fully moving.
Except for the Mac Pros. Except for, you still have to buy a Mac Pro.
Right.
And maybe
the older models that were. We're thinking yeah, we might
and
get
maybe some Mac minis you can find floating around. I have to look and see what's available at Apple Store. But certainly the idea is that, yeah, we're going to move entirely away from Intel at this point.
Yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Do you think Intel should be worried?
I think Intel has been worried since last year, and we'll talk about that with their new chips. But yeah, these things are super powered, super expensive. They're the Mighty Macs, everybody. Mm. So if you've been waiting and hankering for an upgrade, I'm looking at you, Ben. These are kind of the ones you got to get, but also, yeah, expect to take maybe a small loan or pay for them over time, you know, like something.
Is that like your one complaint about them? Like if there's one thing you had to complain
about, expensive.
Is it? Yeah.
They're expensive. And Mac hardware has always been expensive. A high-end notebook has always, like, as great as like laptops have gotten and cheaper and stuff over the years, if you want power, if you want like actual power for production, you got to pay a ton of money. So that's the thing. You can't upgrade these because the RAM is kind of like in there in the system on a chip. So it's not as flexible as maybe a PC laptop would be. But if you get what you pay for, certainly. Also over in Gadget, we reviewed the latest Apple AirPods. Billy still did that. And he calls them better in nearly every way. Gives them a high score of 88. These things look cool. I have not tried them. But certainly if you're in the market for AirPods, they seem like a good deal. I will say if you have weird ears like mine and you've had issues with AirPods in the past, I don't know if these are going to be any better. The AirPods Pro still sound better. They use silicone tips. You know, those still have certain benefits, and they have bigger drivers too. So I still reach for my AirPods Pro like every day because they're the really useful headphones to have around. If I'm working outside and somebody comes up with a leaf blower in my neighbor's yard, I could just throw them on and kind of like dull some of that noise. So, you know, these things don't have that, but as AirPods, they seem really good.
I don't mind that they still have that little like stick hanging out of your ear look, but sure. I think some people may not like it. I don't mind it.
You have other options. If you don't want that, you can go get a Jabra. You know, you could get Galaxy Buds. Like you've got Pixel Buds. So many options right now. Speaking of Pixel, Trillin, what are your final thoughts on the Pixel 6?
I'm so torn. Because I personally am in the phase of switching over my primary Android phone. And I'm like, all right, I guess it's time to like main the Pixel 6s now. But I don't like the size of either of them. And that's my main issue now. And I think it's been echoed in a lot of the YouTube comments that I see, a lot of the tweets. A lot of people agree that like we needed a small baby Pixel. With this year, the regular Pixel 6 is a 6.4-inch screen. And in terms of size, it's about the same as the bigger one, which has a 6.7-inch screen, but, you know, no bezels. So, like, the smaller one has these ugly bezels, too. So I know our managing editor, Terrence O'Brien, himself is thinking of, like, which Pixel 6 to get. And, like, he was like, oh, if the Pixel 6 didn't have those bezels and was just smaller. So I think that's what you're going to hear as main complaints about these things. My chiropractor / sports therapist himself is looking to upgrade from a Pixel 2 to a new Pixel. And he's been asking me the whole time. And he was like, I was like, these are really good phones. He was the first person to remind me that like the fingerprint sensor is like something very important to him. And for those of you who, a lot of people have been asking me this, is it, you know, the fingerprint sensor is bad compared to Samsung and OnePlus phones that have in-screen fingerprint sensors. But is it because it's slow or is it because it's giving false negatives or false positives?
Right.
That's a question that was asked. And, what I realized is that once I learned that I have to put my finger on it for like 2 seconds at a time.
Two seconds
is an exaggeration. Maybe more like 1 second. Like I have to count once or something. Yeah. Once I figured out that I have to do that and be patient, then I realized that actually it does work. It's just, it takes a while. It's not inconsistent. It takes a while. So that's the three main things to complain about these phones stacked up against a list of pros, which start, the first of all is its price. Like you really can't beat this price, right? Like you're starting at $600 for the Pixel 6. And my biggest complaint about it is the fingerprint sensor is slow and it's a little big. And I mean, like, if you're not size sensitive, you definitely could get the Pixel 6 and have a really good time. I think it'll be great. The camera features and a lot of the software features, which were some of the highlights, they're summed up in three words, like hit or miss. It really depends on the situation. Magic Eraser, oh my gosh. Sometimes it's true magic. Sometimes it's like, hold. And what I've realized is when Google is able to automatically detect things in the scene and wants to erase for you, it works amazingly.
Can it erase, like, those friends you don't like who sometimes show up in your photos?
Yes, the photo bomber thing is pretty good.
I have a pile from our like CES trips.
I can't wait to delete
all some. My photos with Sherlyn, basically. So, but yeah.
I was thinking same. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, same.
But look at these comparison pictures on my review, on our review video, or, you know, if you're tuning into our live stream, you'll see them on screen right now. The Magic Eraser tool is pretty insane. When it is able to detect people, it does a really good job. The struggle is when you're trying to erase something that is not already detected for you. Then it has a harder time filling in the background with something that's not so obvious. One of the hosts on Twit's network of podcasts, Ant Pruitt, he did a video of removing a chain link, a fence, not a chain link fence, but a fence in front of a dog with the Pixel 6 Magic Eraser. And I gotta say, the result looked not awful.
You could still see there was a fence there.
Yeah, you could still see the crisscross pattern, but like, a faint,
sure,
sort of slightly pixelated version. I don't know. It's kind of funny.
We're getting there. We're getting there. I mean, Google's always been good at computational photography, I guess, and like their stuff is getting better.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Face Unblur as a tool, Face Unblur is one of the things that I was most impressed by. It's basically supposed to stitch pictures from the wide camera and the main camera when you're shooting your subject that's like as they're moving, and it'll keep their faces sharp and clear by using the wide, more sharp picture to on top of the face, which is like, oh, okay. So when I was shooting our video producer Brian O, as he was shaking his head in front of me, not at me, in front of me, every single shot was crisp. Now I will say that it was not every shot that had Face Unblur applied in that scenario, because for some reason I think just the shutter speed's really fast on these things too. Some of them just didn't have Face Unblur, but they were very clear. But the
seeing
ones
looking at your photos by
them,
the really makes me miss Prospect Park, because you were clearly taking photos around Brian's apartment, and I used to live like right near him. Yeah.
Oh, it's so beautiful in the fall. Mm-hmm. It was some of the that was my favorite part of the testing, was going to Prospect Park to shoot, because again, that's where you take a lot of pictures with your phone, and was the best place to test them. I did so much testing for this phone, so much, and I wrote so many words. Like, my joke is that I almost got fired over how long my review was, but we had to trim it just to make sure it wasn't going too far or like off tangents and whatever. But I say that, like, even in this podcast, I feel like there's still not enough time for me to get into everything.
For sure.
I would recommend just sending me your questions. Hopefully I'll be
able
to
answer
all of them.
Go look at Sherlyn's video review. It's
a very
nice
video
review.
I mean, we cut the video review too. It was going to be like a 20-minute video at some point.
You know,
and then
we're not making a Pixel 6 documentary here. But
look, I might. You don't give me ideas, Devendra, because I might make a Pixel 6 documentary with the Pixel 6.
If people would actually watch technology documentaries, those would be fun things to make.
So people watch them when they're on Netflix, I guess. I got to call up Netflix. Yeah. That's what I got to do. But no, I mean, yeah, do you, like, I know you're not much of an Android phone owner, but did you have anything that jumped out at you when you were looking at the marketing stuff for Pixel 6 or the keynotes that you were interested in?
I mean, I got to remind you, Sherlyn, I've been testing Android phones.
Sure, yeah, of course.
When you were in like journo school, you know,
yes, but
like
Android's come a long way.
It's come a long way. I was there at the beginning to kind of see so many things, and it is really fascinating to see like how far Google has come. Certainly, I've seen like several failed attempts at flagship phones from Google to the Nexus line.
The Nexuses were good, but yes,
they were good. They were good phones. The Nexus 4, I think, was like really, really hot.
Yeah.
And the that 6P. Competition back in the day when like, a lot of cool features immediately came to Android and didn't, like, it took iPhone forever to even get LTE and stuff like that. It was really cool to see Android grow up. I think over the past couple of years, things seem to get maybe a little dull, just because Samsung is such a monolith. Like, Samsung just comes in,
dominates,
became the flagship. Yeah, dominates, is the Sony of the, you know, Android world, basically. They're the one everybody's following. Samsung is like, we want big phones. Everybody wants big phones. And then everybody start making big phones. And that's kind of the key. That's the key of when a company becomes a consumer electronics leader, right? Everybody's starting to follow what they're doing. The Fold, kind of the same thing. Like, they're trying new things. Whereas Google has been sitting like, Pixel phones are cheap, I guess. Like, they're fine. Like, it just feels like they've been kind of treading water.
Yeah. I guess, but I think with since Samsung sort of started to dominate, in my opinion, from the S5 onwards.
Yes.
Where they introduced water resistance, and I was like, wait, what the hell? We can make our phones water resistant now? And then it was like, okay. And then LG died. RIP. HTC
LG
died. RIP.
HTC died. Yeah.
and then here's Google chugging along. And since the Pixel 3, I feel like Google has been clearly aware that actually it offers a lot of benefits through its software. And as long as it can get all the basics sorted on hardware, it can really offer you super-powered software and offer a very unique selling point that Samsung can't. And I think that there's a little bit of like a conflict of interest there, obviously, because like, you know, Google provides Android to Samsung, so it can't really like make some features.
Android is open source, you know, like Samsung is open to, it's kind of like the Windows situation, right?
Right, and right.
The Windows situation was fine until Microsoft started making their own computers. And then like some of that conflict started happening.
Yes, so, exactly. Yeah. And this, I mean, Google's been making their own phones for a while. So it's like not a huge deal by this point because they figured out what to do. There's Pixel UI. Oh my gosh. And Pixel UI is, I think, what stands out for me with Pixel phones. I love Pixel UI. And with the Pixel 6s, Google also offers some AI stuff. Like, the voice typing is actually really good. It just needs to learn where better to insert punctuation. Translation is incredible. That translation, like, I mean, setting aside the quirks of translation engines to begin with, the fact that none of them can get colloquialisms right, none of them can get, you know, away from sounding formal and stilted. Just the fact that it's built into so many places and works so quickly. That tensor processing unit on the tensor chip is insanely fast for all of these tasks. Like, just all the voice recognition, all the translations happening really quickly on these phones. If you like those features, you're going to get a real kick out of this phone. But, like, I don't use translation a lot in my life, so who knows yet? I will say go ahead.
The tensor chip is really interesting. Yes. I just want to put this out there because that is like where Google's like, oh, we can do this. We can build this. We can do our own unique things. There's some like AI processing and stuff in there that nobody else has really. So that's interesting. But it involved Google like literally making the brains of the phone to make their phones interesting. So not everybody can do that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what's surprising is that like just to compare, we ran Geekbench 5 on the iPhone 13, so A15 Bionic, Pixel 6, so Tensor, and then the Surface Duo was the closest phone I had with a Snapdragon 888, so I ran it on the 888 as well. And like the Tensor, despite having two X1 cores, the prime cores, was the slowest of the lot on the results. It had like a 2800-ish score on Geekbench CPU. Not compute. I think compute might get better just because. But on CPU, it lost to both the Bionic A15 Bionic and the Snapdragon 888. So A15 was the best score, 4,800 something, and the Snapdragon 888 got like 3,600 ish or 3,800 ish, and Google came in like 1,000.
That's weird. I will say like, and as somebody who runs a lot of benchmarks, benchmarks aren't everything. Everybody
sure,
like it's a standard to say like, I can run this fast, okay? But if Google can also build, you know, a chip that can run fast enough, but also offload the work to do like camera processing and voice processing and stuff, that won't show up in the benchmark. Like
what I was about to lead into, which is that the thing is that like, but all of that camera processing that's really fast, like if you like look, okay, so score to score, right? The Snapdragon 888 on the Surface Duo 2 higher than the Tensor's 2000 something. But the Surface Duo 2's camera was so freaking slow, whereas with the Pixel 6 and 6 Pro, it was flying. Pictures 20 in a second. I can tell you, like, it's insanely fast. And like anything to do with AI, anything with voice translation, voice recognition, all just happened really quickly. So yeah, to your point and the point that I was getting to is that like, I don't think Geekbench results take into consideration things like the TPU and ISP performance, at least not in the general score sense. So I'm willing to set aside the scores and for its first chip, I think Google did well. I think that, like, anyway, Tensor, here you go.
Speed That's and experience. Thing, yeah. Like, yes, when we judge products too, like, yes, the way it feels in your hand, the way, like, the actual responsiveness of when you're using it, I think sometimes does matter more than the benchmark. So yeah, yes, it's worth considering.
So yeah. The final thing I want to say is, like, there was this mm-hmm. funny moment when Brian speaks Korean and understands German. I mm-hmm. speak Mandarin and understand a whole bunch of other things. So we were like, okay, I'll do some translation uh-huh. examples for this video. Uh-huh. Chinese to English, great. Korean to English, great. Korean to Chinese? Neither of us could make head or tail of what the other were saying. It was like, in Chinese, we say, 鸡头不对鸭嘴. Sure. Anyway, mm-hmm. Like the chicken head doesn't match the duck's tongue or tongue duck's mouth. It's a saying. It's just, uh-huh. you're not understanding each other, basically. And it's a... Mm-hmm. Anyhow, that was
It's nice to see they're making progress. Like, I think Apple kind of needs a dedicated Siri chip, because I swear, any time, even no matter which Apple device I'm using, Siri's just so dumb. So dumb. Like, yeah. I shout, hey, blanky. I shout her name a lot for, like, random things.
Yep.
Siri's, like, sitting right next to me. Nothing. Never responds. Same. Never, yep. like, it's never, and then when I do it, sometimes the thing in front of me doesn't hear it, but the iPad across the room starts responding. I'm like, no, stop. You should be smart enough to know this.
I will say, I have the same exact thing with yep. the assistant at home. I have Nest mm-hmm. audio speakers, and I have the smart display at my kitchen. I'll be
Everybody
standing
has
in
to
front
fix
of
this.
The, right, yeah. everyone, they need to understand mm-hmm. that, like, yes, some of us live in big houses, but some of us live in tight spaces. And I know
Google
tried.
You have a lot of devices.
Yeah, uh-huh. it did the whole, like, tweak your sensitivity thing. I made the smart display sensitivity, mm-hmm. like, the lowest of the low. And it still can hear me from all the way, like, in my bedroom, where the Nest audio just won't hear me. Which I don't even understand what's going on there.
It's weird, because it's like, you want that. You want them to be able to hear you.
Yes.
But if you have multiple devices, you want it also to be smart enough to be like, okay, the one I'm holding in my hand should be the thing you're hitting and not the thing over there. Anyway, these are all problems everybody has to solve. And
Lots of problems.
I'm happy to hear the Pixel 6 and 6 Pro sound good. Sound pretty exciting. If I didn't push my wife away from Android last year, because that just makes our family life and communicating so much easier, I would have gotten her one of these.
Yeah. I think she would have loved it. But, you know, it's okay. She's on your family plan now.
Family plan, the blue chat bubbles, iMessage.
By family plan, I meant, like, your family ecosystem. Yes.
Well, also my family, like, Apple plans and whatnot. Like, we can share subscriptions, you know? We can share things in the way that Apple and Android can't quite yet. So.
You can't cross the boundaries, yeah.
Not at all. And maybe that's why we'll never see iMessage on Android. Like, Apple knows what it's got, and this is how it gets people to move over. Hey, everyone. Before we get to our Facebook section, I just want to point out a pretty big update that came after our recording. Mark Zuckerberg officially announced that he's rebranding Facebook as Meta. He said during the Facebook Connect keynote today, "Our brand is so tightly linked to one product that it can't possibly represent everything that we're doing today, let alone the future. From now on, we're going to be Metaverse first, not Facebook first." This move also means Facebook is giving up on branding like virtual reality labs, and it's also killing the Oculus brand entirely. The Oculus Quest is going to be rebranded to the Meta Quest sometime next year. Now onto the rest of our conversation, and we'll start learning how to replace Facebook with Meta. One other major piece of news that happened this week is the release of the Facebook Papers. Tons and tons of files from whistleblower Francis Haugen that was released to many dozens of media organizations, and everybody kind of like did a concerted effort and tried to publish around the same time. It seems like we're just learning a lot about how Facebook is continuously very, very awful. So joining us to talk about all this is Carissa Bell, senior editor in Gadget, who covers social networking for us. Hey, Carissa, how's it going?
Hey, good to be here.
Hello, and hello again to talk about Facebook's absolute mess. You were on like earlier a couple of weeks ago, like, you know, to discuss the reveal of the leaker, kind of what this all means. And now we have just had like a deluge of reports over the last week. So could you give us like, what are some of the highlights from the Facebook paper so far? And what is it telling us that the like original Wall Street Journal reporting didn't tell us a couple of months ago?
Yeah, I mean, there's just, it's a little overwhelming because there's just so much.
So much.
Yeah. And, you know, it turns out that, you know, there's kind of something for everyone here. Like if you're Politico, then there's stories about Facebook's lobbying. You know, if you are internationally focused publication, there's lots of stories about Facebook's kind of failures and misdeeds in other parts of the world that aren't talked about as much in Western media. Mm-hmm. You know, I think kind of a lot of it all kind of comes down to sort of like the same themes, which is, you know, like Facebook's moderation failures, you know, both here and abroad, how the various ways that Haugen and others say that Facebook has put profit over safety.
Yep.
You know, I think one of the things that might be more consequential for the company is that, you know, these documents are linked to an SEC complaint, and there's going to be an investigation. And, you know, one of the main allegations is that Facebook has misled its investors, misled its shareholders, its advertisers about sort of some of the, you know, some of these like really big issues, as like losing teen users, that they know that they have a lot of duplicate accounts. You know, those are the kind of things that might actually result in possibly some kind of action from an SEC or regulatory body. You know, but like these things are still coming out. They're going to be coming out for several more weeks now. So I think there's a lot more that we're going to keep seeing.
There's just so like it is easier to get overwhelmed because there's so much reporting. But it all just seems to kind of like coalesce around the idea that Facebook is very, very big right now, and they have no way to like control the power and the conversation of its own social network, right? So when it comes to things like hate speech, there's a lot of talk about like there's a lot of abuse towards women in other countries. Many things like climate denialism, like there was a point where some workers tried to like keep I forget the specifics of it, but they were basically like trying to stop censoring climate denialism, and one of the Facebook leaders or managers allowed that to kind of keep going. Do you have any like broad takeaways from everything we're seeing right now?
I mean, I think it shows one thing that kind of stands out is that you see that Facebook does have a lot of really thoughtful employees who work there because they care about kind of fixing these big problems, and they want to come up with sort of creative ways to solve it. And then they're not able to do so for whatever reason. A lot of times, you know, like you said, there's somebody at the top who, you know, is dealing with some other consideration other than just kind of fixing the problem. You mentioned the climate denialism. There was one about that related to COVID-19 misinformation, how Zuckerberg sort of waffled in the beginning of the pandemic. I think one of the more damning things was that the WhatsApp team wanted to build a voting information center in 2020.
Yep.
You know, sort of like the voting information center that Facebook had, and do a Spanish language version on WhatsApp. And Zuckerberg said that won't be politically neutral thing for Facebook to do.
Voting is certainly, yeah, just the act of voting is not neutral. That's the sort of thing that just makes my blood boil too. Like just looking at where we are in America right now, as like a lot of like conservative politicians are trying to curb voting rights and like trying to like, you know, limit the ability for people to vote. And if fewer people vote, then basically if more people vote Democratic. Like that's generally kind of how it goes. So it is kind of sad to me to see like how Facebook is kind of playing a role in a lot of these like in a lot of these like conservative leaning policies. We don't have any broad takeaways right now. Like this is such a flood of information, Carissa. How do you feel as a reporter? Like how do you? I feel like it's hard when like a new gadget arrives, you know, and I have to like do all this testing and think about what it means. But you're dealing with actual important stuff. How are you surviving, and how are you like trying to figure out like what is worth paying attention to amid like all this news coming out?
Yeah, I mean it's hard. I think a lot of people who are covering this are kind of struggling just under like the amount of
It's like you have thousands of pages to read every day, basically. If you're looking at all these docs,
You know, I think for me, a lot of it is just kind of looking at those sort of like bigger themes, you know, because especially as these stories keep coming out, a lot of them, if you read them closely, it's, you know, kind of like maybe there's one or two new details, you know, but a lot of the bigger picture stuff that's being led is things that we've already known, things that have already been extensively reported on. I mean, this is all kind of just becoming more evidence of all the things that we kind of already suspected or knew about how Facebook behaves in the world. I think what's going to be more interesting to see how Facebook can hold up to the pressure that all this is creating. You know, they are, you know, they've shown, their history has shown us that they're like very good at kind of deflecting any kind of scandal or
ignoring it or
But I mean, this feels different, you know, and there's rumors that they're going to rename themselves, which would be a pretty convenient distraction.
Well, we will find out in a couple hours and probably by the time you're listening to this podcast. So actually, that is something worth talking about. Carissa, like we were talking about, like what we expect around Facebook Connect, which is going to be their big kind of like virtual. It used to be Oculus Connect. It is where they typically dive into like what their plans are for VR and AR and stuff. But it seems like the metaverse is going to be a big topic this year. And there are also the rumors that they may end up changing their names to kind of reflect that too. What do you think about Facebook kind of like pushing on with like this brand new vision and like a whole, you know, trying to enter new territory while, you know, its house is on fire? It's like they're trying to move across the street and their house is still on fire right now. So I don't know if that's responsible or anything. What are your thoughts?
I think it's sort of quintessential Zuckerberg, you know, where he just like he just wants to keep building things. You know, he says that he wants to like fix these problems too. But I think what we're seeing from these documents is that like he had, when he's had the opportunity to do so, he hasn't. And, you know, he definitely likes to, you know, think of himself as a sort of like really important technologist who's, you know, shaping the future and all that. And so, you know, I think being able to like pivot and say, well, I'm going to focus on the metaverse now and Facebook.
Deal with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Facebook's future is the metaverse. It's not, you know, the blue app. It's not, you know, WhatsApp groups inciting violence and all these things. I think, you know, it makes perfect sense from that point of view. I think whether people are by it and, you know, the world is ready for a metaverse or even ready to understand what he's even talking about when he says that, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Just Sherlyn, like any thoughts about the stuff that has been dropping or where Facebook's going?
I just like, you know, I'm looking at this long list of the Google Docs that collects all the Facebook stories from this from these papers. And it's a really, really long list and chronicled by the day and I'm sorry, recorded or collected by the day. I just think about, Carissa, your job. Like, what is, like, at this stage, like, what's your daily workflow look like? Now you wake up and you go and look at the papers a little bit more and see. And also, I know there's a limited number of the pages out here. We're still waiting for more of them to be released. But is like, what are reporters having access to right now? And what is sort of the process of going through some of that stuff? Is it going to a website to download all of them to look at them at your own time? Or do you have to be in touch with someone's PR person like Facebook tried to smear a while back? Like, what's it all look like?
Yeah, so that's actually, that's a good question there. And I should point out that, so I'm not officially part of the consortium, you know, the sort of, I guess, official group of journalists who are like getting access to these like through Hoggins channels. I think you know, there's a whole sort of like media meta narrative about like how
it's a super club. Yeah
You know, Gizmodo has been publishing a lot of these documents. There's, you know, a few other folks who are trying to make them more readable, because one of the challenges is that like all of these documents are like photos of a computer screen.
Yeah, that's hard.
So they're like, some of them are, you know, not the easiest to read. They're definitely not, you know, something you can search or like use like normal like PDF software on necessarily. You know, so and that makes it even harder. I think, again, it's like sort of just looking for those themes, like looking at what the actual documents are. You know, some of them are just sort of based on like an employee post on Workplace. And some comments, things like that, which, you know, I think are important because they show you what employees are thinking, but they're not necessarily on the same level as like these sort of like bigger research documents that were prepared for like, you know, leadership at the company, for example.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see like what all this leads to, just because Hey, I'm old enough to remember when Microsoft got in trouble for a web browser. Okay, and got in serious trouble for a web browser.
Carissa, yeah. This is our 100th episode, and DaVinci's been taking a lot of walks down memory lane. It's been great.
But also, listen, if you're going to understand the present, you got to understand the past. And
I agree.
It is wild that all this stuff is happening a while ago. In the late 90s, 20 plus years ago, Microsoft was in deep, deep shit for prioritizing Internet Explorer over Netscape Navigator in Windows, and now
we have a company
for one thing. And that took them years to kind of deal with in court and like kind of deal with a solution. Facebook, it's like relentless, the amount of things that Facebook is breaking in our society and in democracies and in so many things. So do you have any sense of like how it seems like regulation is more on the table than ever, but do you have any sense of like how governments and people will end up responding to all this?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. Like, there's already been several hearings about these issues just here in our Congress. Elizabeth Warren tweeted yesterday that now she's like extra motivated to see Facebook broke up. The FTC is reportedly having a look at these documents. So, and Facebook itself told its employees, you know, that they kind of have to preserve all their communication, you know, which signals that they're sort of staring down some serious investigations. So it does seem like we are going to see something come out of this. Like, nobody really knows what, you know, because it's one of those things that, you know, Hogan herself, when she appeared in the Senate a while back, she, you know, she had some really thoughtful ideas on you know, what could happen, like Section 230 reform, you know, changing Facebook's algorithms in some way, you know, but those are hardly widely agreed on steps that should be taken. There's still a lot of disagreement about how to do this correctly.
There's so many. I just want to point out too, like there was pushback against as Frances Haugen was talking to UK lawmakers. I think she revealed like more of her thoughts about how things work within Facebook and the things she'd want to fix. And she was talking about limiting encryption. And that is something I know privacy advocates are very, very careful about how they talk about, right? Because being able to having less encryption will allow like more moderation of content and stuff and may help like with bad things and bad groups of people talking together. But in terms of privacy, it's a bad, bad thing. Have you thought about that, Carissa, and kind of like how, I don't think she is, you know, not all of her opinions are the things everybody is agreeing with. So it is kind of interesting like how this is all shaping up too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hard thing to balance. When you talk about walking back encryption, you know, that's something that Zuckerberg has been very bullish on. But like a lot of others, you know, in the wider tech security community are as well, because a lot of these places where Facebook operates, they have authoritarian governments. They have, you know, people who, you know, really need to feel safe on the internet. And maybe you can argue whether like WhatsApp is like the best version of encryption that's out there. But, you know, when you talk about taking away some of those protections, like, I think we have a pretty good idea that like people will be more at risk in some places. So, you know, I think it's a conversation like worth having about, and like, you know, looking at sort of what the trade-offs are there. But I think, you know, that's something that a lot of people are rightfully saying that they would need to be really careful about doing.
Seems like we need more people in charge who kind of understand the broader risks and stuff involved in all of this. But just want to say thank you so much, Carissa, for joining us again to chat about all this. We are definitely going to have you on, like, as we get more revelations. It is nice to have somebody we could talk to who has also been thinking about this while I'm off thinking about gadgets. Like, I wish I could read every single bit of this Facebook reporting, but there's not enough time in the day. So yeah, where can people find you on the internet, Carissa?
On Twitter, at CarissaBE.
Let's move on to some other news. And we've got a couple tidbits of like chip news and OS news today. Why don't you kick it off, Sherlyn?
Yeah, this week iOS 15.1 was released. Not only did it bring with it SharePlay on Fitness Plus, which will allow you to group workouts with your friends. I'm so excited to test it out. So excited to test it out with UK viewer Chief Matt Smith. But also it brought about just SharePlay in general. As a recap, SharePlay is that thing where you can call your friends over FaceTime and watch Ted Lasso together on the stream.
Yay.
And it's so much fun, and you can you watch TikToks together. I had a briefing with Apple this week to preview some of the apps that are coming to get to SharePlay, and just ended up writing a guide about it. So you guys can check out Engadget.com for that. It's just how to SharePlay on iOS 15. But
I appreciate it. It's hard.
It's just a new thing that we all sort of should learn, like what the functions and the controls are. I thought it's like it's a brand new function. I didn't know actually that when you were screen sharing over SharePlay to someone, your the person on the other end can zoom in to things on your screen like that you're sharing. That's the only thing they can do, but they can. So like,
they can.
If you have something, something hidden in a pixel somewhere, yeah, they can zoom in and see it.
Close
so
those bad browser tabs. Yeah.
Yeah. Close all your tabs. But they can't see your alerts. Yeah. They can't like pop
do your hentai research screen. Elsewhere. Yes.
Yeah.
That was the thing that happened on Twitter.
Oh no.
I forget who it was, but yeah.
Research. Okay, sure.
Somebody was like, no. They posted a screenshot and there was like hentai in the tab. And he was like, I was looking up what hentai was. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what it That's means. Okay. I didn't turn on tentacle porn for like, anyway. Now I got distracted. But I wrote this guide mostly because why is screen sharing over SharePlay going to be good? Because it's going to help you. Or those of us who need to tech support over
all your
miles
parents.
And miles of land. Yep. Yeah. I don't care who it is. Parents, kids, neighbors, relatives, whatever it is. You got to do tech support. This could be a good tool. The thing is, you got to first teach them how to use SharePlay to screen share with you. So here's the guide. Just tell them to read the guide.
That's great.
That's what I'm going to do to my parents. I'm like, can you just read this before I help you with anything?
And they're going to be like, I have to read what you wrote? Gross.
Yeah, my parents actually beg me to share my work with them because I'm just like, no, don't look at the videos. Anyway.
Don't tell them about Twitter and everything.
Oni-chan. Oni-chan. It's actually. Uh-huh. Anyway. So there's iOS 15.1, Apple's very cool update that brings, I mean, by cool, I mean the feature SharePlay, I think is very cool.
SharePlay actually, seems really cool. And also SharePlay for Apple Fitness Plus, so you could do it with friends too. That's fun.
Yeah. Group workouts, up to 32 people, y'all. And not everyone's stats will be on screen all the time, but you get to see your friends sweat it out, and whoever's the loudest will be on the tile as active speaker
okay.
in the PIP. So, okay, cool. Yeah. So check it out. I mean, there's quite a lot of little nitty gritty things in there, right? Like you all have to be subscribers. You all have to be have the app on your phone. I had to install TikTok to do this demo, Devendra.
I don't understand the TikTok hate. But yeah,
I don't hate it. I'm just like, I don't use it at all. So
TikTok could be your ticket to success, Sherlyn. Embrace it.
I mean,
I'm already,
that's true. A lot of people, I don't know. We'll see what the next big thing is.
Yeah.
I also downloaded, the NBA app to check this out. It also works with the NBA app. So you can watch live games on your phone or TV with your iPad with whoever. Oh, and you can turn off your camera and your microphone so you can go take a toilet break but still remain in the conversation.
Please remember to do that. I'm not a fan of when people forget to do that during group chats. Speaking of OS updates, there is something I think you've been waiting for coming to Android from Google.
I wasn't waiting for this because I wasn't expecting Google.
We talk about it so often.
But I know, but we complain about Android on larger screens a lot. And I think Google somewhere heard us. They were like, oh, crap, the Engadget podcast specifically.
Yeah.
we really
give us heat for this. Yeah.
We really don't want Sherlyn or Devendra to be mad. So this week it announced Android 12L. Android 12L, the L stands for large, I'm assuming. And it's basically designed for different screen sizes, sort of the way Windows 10X was supposed to. Be cognizant of different states and screen sizes. Anyway, Google's pitching this as for larger screens and foldable screens. So not only will it have, two column settings panels and two columns notification shades when it detects that your screen's wider than 600 dips, it'll be able to also, it'll enable developers to know when the hinge is sort of slightly folded and let their apps make use of that so-called natural separator. It'll also be adding a taskbar, making it look a lot more like Chrome OS. And this taskbar will not only make it easier for you to just find your more frequently used apps, but also split screen more easily by just dragging and dropping these apps onto the screen. It looks good. Funny thing is, it looks very similar to some of the things that other companies like Samsung have had to do to make Android look nice on a bigger screen.
They had to build it themselves, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So now Android's baking that in. I saw a comment on our YouTube chat earlier asking if it is more fragmentation of Android. I don't feel like this is fragmenting, if only because it's 12L is sort of like built into 12, and it really, all these features only kick in when they detect a certain type of screen width. So it's still there. You just won't see it on a phone.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's still
Google needs to do this. Like, this is exactly what we were complaining about, is that Android, for the past decade, this is 10 years too late, but decade, Android has basically been like, well, you got a big screen, you got big Android. That's it. Yeah. Like, they didn't do anything different to make Android work well or seem nice on tablets. And it just seems like complete negligence on Google's part to, like, let this market completely run away, right?
I agree. I mean, like, maybe Android tablets stand a chance now. Like, Samsung sure hasn't given up making them, because Samsung also just made software to try and make that work. Samsung was like, all right, Dex, we're gonna give you Dex, y'all. And then, nope, that was just not great. I mean, I think Dex is still going to stick around, because Dex does offer some different things. Dex offers a start screen to begin with, a homepage, I mean, that looks more
like desktop. By Dex, do you mean the thing where you plug it into a monitor?
Well, Dex also exists as a mode on tablets that you can turn on and off. Yeah, or if you attach a keyboard to a tablet, it'll come up Dex mode. But yes, that is what I'm referring to. But I mean, Dex also offers that, like a more desktop-looking interface, also like resizable windows. That are floating panels, not just like split screen resizable windows. But this is the start. I think there's a long way to go for Android. I think there's things they could learn, honestly, from Samsung, who weirdly enough has so much more experience in trying to make Android work for larger screens. Come the F on.
But why is Samsung the one investing in all this stuff when Google's right there? What are you doing, Google?
I think to just close out that thought, this year it seems like Google is realizing Samsung's been doing a lot of the work that it should have, especially with the Wear OS side of things. They teamed up with Samsung to make some of that work. Now they're doing 12L, where it looks like they're learning that tablets deserve a better UI. And maybe they'll look to Samsung again on 12L to learn a bit about. But I am encouraged. Like, this is a good first step. There's more that can be done. There's a lot that developers have to do to make their apps work with 12L as well. Not a lot, but like, they have to do some work.
I can just imagine, like, I think a fun dream job would be just like being a Google product manager, but with like ultimate power, and just like going in there and be like, what are you guys doing? Tablets, do Android tablets, do something more here. Like, let's just make this work.
I feel like they
need a kick in the pants or something to kind of make this happen. So I guess Samsung has been that kick in the pants to Google for the past couple of years.
I'm friendly with some of the product managers, and I think they're all kind of like focusing. What I mean is they're all focusing on their own things. So maybe they needed someone on top of tablets for like, they needed to create a role to synergize and
visionaries, speed up designers. There needs to be somebody like visualize, point over here and be like, we need to do this. We need to go there. Whereas I feel like
catalyze. Done, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Catalyze.
Catalyze the process.
So annoying. Well, anyway, talking about companies have been kind of disappointing for years and are trying really hard to compete. Let's talk about Intel's 12th gen CPUs. And they just announced these things. They're just called the 12th gen line. But these are the Alder Lake chips we've talked about over the past few years. This is their first attempt at doing a hybrid design. So similar to basically what ARM has been doing for the past decade, again, on the mobile side, these things have up to 8 P-core, performance cores, and to 8 E-cores, or efficient cores. So at the high end, the 12900K has 16 cores in total, but it's like half and half, 8 performance, 8 E. And it is a combined chip. It is a new way of thinking of how an Intel CPU works. They tried this hybrid design with their Lakefield chips, I think last year. It didn't really end up in too many machines. But this is their next big stab. It is based on the Intel 7 architecture, which, again, we talked about this a couple months ago. They renamed their entire design process. So Intel 7 is actually their like upgraded 10 nanometer design. It's a whole thing. I will say, looking at the numbers we're getting from Intel around these things, it does seem good. It does seem like this hybrid design is smart, especially for an OS like Windows, where there are a lot of like background processes and things where it's like, okay, put the weaker chips over here. Let them just like churn out this work, where the high powered ones can focus on the game or the encoding or whatever you're doing. Intel claims P cores can perform up to 28% faster than its 10th gen Comet Lake chips, and the E cores are basically just the 10th gen chips, with like no upgrades overall. And I think like they're just like saying there are a lot of big upgrades overall. The 12th gen chips are up to 19% faster overall. Intel claims the 12900K is 50% faster than last year's 11900K in multi-threaded performance while using less power. So it is a whole new way of thinking it. They don't just have like 8 cores working really hard at high power, and the 11th gen chips were really, really hot too. So those got a lot of criticism. Now they could be like, okay, let's put some stuff on the E cores. Let's put some stuff on the P cores. Let's kind of work together to kind of do a lot of concurrent tasks. So especially when it comes to multitasking, they're saying these things are going to be a big upgrade. A 50% jump, you know, at a lower power level is pretty wild to me. And gaming as well, they're saying like 30% better than the 11900K in a game like Troy, A Total War Saga. Some big benchmarks all around. Okay. Just big numbers. Yeah.
I'm not as familiar with like Intel architecture. Is this the first time they're using this sort of big little design?
They've talked about it for a while. And I think last year I mentioned they had the Lakefield chip. And that, I think that was just for like really low powered laptops and stuff. It wasn't really in too many devices. But yeah, this is big little, basically.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's a big upgrade overall. The real question is, what does this mean when comparing it to like the Apple chips, right? Like, what does this mean compared to M1 and everything? And, you know, that's where things are going to get confusing. Like, I think there is a benchmark leak that suggests the 12900K, which is the fastest of these new chips, is faster than the M1 Max, you know? But the M1 Max chip is still a laptop chip. It's still, like, a much lower wattage, a power-sipping chip. Once Apple brings that design over to like the Mac Mini or a Mac Pro, I still feel like Intel is going to be a little toast. The benchmarks we saw from Intel also, they showed us AMD benchmarks before AMD and Microsoft fixed some of the bugs with those chips in Windows 11. So there may be some slowdown there. I'll wait to see if like they give us any new benchmarks. And honestly, I just want to get a hold of these chips in some machines soon and test them out. They seem like a big deal. So if you waited on upgrading, if you didn't upgrade to an 11th gen chip, I think you lucked out, because those things were kind of, they just weren't decent upgrades. And in some cases, they were even slower than 10th gen chips. So, you know, kind of a waste. 12th gen looks good. We'll be keeping an eye on everything. And as usual, what happens is that Intel announces stuff now. By CES time, by like January and February, AMD is going to be like, hey, here's our new stuff. And Intel is going to be scrambling. This back and forth between Intel, AMD, and Apple now, I think, is really exciting. And it shows like the chip industry is heating up. We're going to see some really cool stuff happening because of this competition. I think that's ultimately a good thing for consumers. Yeah. And I don't know. Do you have any thoughts, Sherlyn? Like, you excited to see Intel try something different?
Yes, definitely. I think it's like big little architecture makes a lot of sense to me in general. Just like, oh, why not? I've never really given it much thought on like something like a laptop, right? Like what task would you relegate to an E core? But maybe it's playing music. Maybe it's that whole like detecting if like trying to keep your machine always ready to respond to you thing. Or, you know, because on phones, it makes a lot of sense. Phones are constantly sensing all kinds of different things and doing a lot of things that are low power, but like not necessarily like running all the time. But it's going to be nice to see how that performs on laptops.
it's especially like, especially when it comes to true multitasking, right? Like
yeah.
playing a game and streaming over OBS at the same time on the same right. machine. And Intel is saying the 12900K is around 84% faster while playing Mountain Blade 2 and streaming over OBS compared to the 11th gen chip. Yeah, 47% faster
nice.
While multitasking Adobe Lightroom Classic and Premiere Pro. Big numbers. And yeah. you talk to a lot of streamers, especially people who do this professionally, like our video yeah. producer, Julio. You need to have two computers. You need to have one computer just for video.
Right.
One computer for playing the game. That's not feasible for everybody, I think. So this new design kind of opens the door for more flexibility and yeah. true multitasking. So, yeah, we'll be keeping an eye out for all of that. Yeah.
Hey, speaking of companies that are struggling to remain relevant in whichever world.
Love these segues, yeah. They're all working really well.
Yeah, I know. I just borrowed yours, copy and paste it right here. But that are not doing so great compared to their competitors, though. Sony this week had a bunch of news. We all know that Sony was going to announce something soon, and it did. The Xperia Pro 1. This is the follow-up to the Sony Xperia Pro from earlier. I almost said last year, that's why I paused. Uh-huh. But it's mm-hmm. a follow-up to this year's Xperia Pro. It was announced at the start of the year. It was $2,500 and was a phone that was just for video pros. It's really just like stuffed to the guts with, like stuffed to the brim with a lot of good video features. This time around, the Xperia Pro 1, the most attention-grabbing thing about it is its 1-inch sensor that is borrowed from the RX100 series.
That's
the
a
RX 107.
Deal.
Yeah. yeah, it's mm-hmm. insane. How? What the hell? The Pixel Pro, they're all boasting about their 1/1.3-inch sensor. I'm like, okay, but this is a 1-inch. Like, it's an RX100 in a phone. Which is, that's why it's a big deal, right? It's also got 2.4 microns size pixels compared to the Pixel 6 Pro, which is 1.2 microns. This is mm-hmm. twice the size. Which I mean,
so you can get like real bokeh from this lens. Like you could do some real,
it'd be so pixel gorgeous. Work. Yeah. yeah. Oh my yeah. gosh. I mean, the RX100 series is one of my favorites in the it's point great. And shoot. Mm-hmm. Pro-ish level of point and shoot. Anyway, it's mm-hmm. it's really good. The lens is on that. It's good, but we'll see, right? So this one has Sony's like imaging processors. So it's got like 20 FPS burst shooting and then autofocus, auto exposure enabled. So like. Oh man, this is taking me back to the days when they covered cameras and reviewed them. Mm-hmm. But all of the mm-hmm. all of those specs, right? Very high up there. 24 millimeter lens between f2 mm-hmm. and f4 apertures. I mean, and then it's got what, a Snapdragon 888, which we just talked about. It's a very powerful. Yeah.
I will say the people watching us on video right now, this is a different phone, actually, right?
You mean the stream on the, yeah. So yeah. I'm not actually looking at our video feed right now. The Pro 1. Yeah, the Pro 1 looks a little different on the back. It's like this black... it's got a different finish from its regular Xperia phones, too, I will say. Mm-hmm. People might be confused because this week we also published our review of the Xperia 1 Mark III, which is
so confusing.
Still an expensive phone.
Stop!
Right. Still an expensive phone, but not the great, not the like $2,500 Pro-level phone that we're talking about right now that Sony announced. The 1 Mark III review that we published this week by Matt Smith is... It's just another one of Sony's Xperia yeah. One phones.
It's a one, but it's not a pro phone. It's not just the pro. All so
and it's
confusing.
Mark III, just in case you were thinking it was Mark Dell. I'm sorry, I meant Mark One. Mark Dell being one of our regular viewers, listeners, audience members. But yeah, it's a very intriguing phone. It's just not made for everyone, right? At $2,500, I mean... It's supposed
well, this thing
to
is $1,800,
in
right?
the U.S. Yeah. for $1,800. Yeah. $2,500 was the original Pro starting price.
Right,
this is
right.
now going for $1,800, which, like, I guess is the same price as a Z Fold 3.
That's how much I paid for a full-frame compact camera, you know, for right. pretty much that price. So,
like, if the camera yeah. quality of this is that good, I might just buy that and go to CES with it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to drag yeah. around my DSLR anymore. Anyhow, worth keeping an eye on. I'm pretty sure we will be mm-hmm. calling this in to review. We don't have it on hand yet. But
is there? There's no zoom, is there? I feel like there's no mechanical zoom. From
I don't think
see.
There's an optical. Just, yeah. If there is, it would be one of those folded mirror ones. But I don't see.
No.
Yeah, it's not. So,
fixed lens. Yeah.
I yeah, fixed. But there are extra additional lens camera options. There's a 50 millimeter telephoto on the side, and then it has an ultra wide option as well. So it's like a triple camera system. But you know, people apparently wanted a setup that matched their collection of prime lenses, and that's probably why they went with a non-zooming main lens. And then you have options for zooming if you need it. 50 millimeters is pretty impressive, I think.
So, yep.
There you go. That should get you, like, I don't know, depending on how they do it, four times? I don't know. I think that was close to the Pixel. Anyhow, we will be reviewing that. We'll get you the picture samples. We'll put someone good on that review, because I don't know if I want to be reviewing it.
A good camera nerd, maybe James. Yeah. We shall
probably
see.
James, Steve. Yeah. Maybe yeah. You know, we got.
Check out all our reviews, and we've got a lot of folks who like specialize in different things. So
yes,
you know, we've got so much content.
They're good
out
at
there.
Their respective beats.
Rounding out the news.
Yes,
right.
Go ahead.
One more thing.
Oh my god!
Dune Part 2.
Woohoo!
Dune Part 2, and. I had mentioned last week that the I think one of the has been confirmed this week. I just want to say that.
Yeah.
But I had mentioned last week that probably the worst part of Denis Villeneuve's Dune is that it kind of just ends and we had no idea if they would even make part two. Like, don't give me this beautiful world and mm-hmm. these great actors and stuff and just like drop it, which has happened before for so many franchises. I'm thinking of like the time they did The Golden Compass with Nicole mm-hmm. Kidman and Daniel Craig, like just ended because that movie wasn't popular
oh my
enough.
God, that one,
so yeah,
I was
Dune part two coming October 20th, 2023.
So good.
Confirmed. I feel like they just had to. They probably just want to like push people to go to the theater and be like,
yes.
I don't know if we're going to make this if you don't actually
support
go see it.
Yeah.
So they refused to confirm it. Yeah.
I had no doubt in my mind they were going to do it because of the hype, because of like, I mean, it seemed like it was going to be a great production anyway, but I feel like you're right. They were trying to make sure people went out and saw it to clinch this second part.
And
but
it's done well in theaters. Like, it is the best simultaneous HBO Max and theatrical premiere ever. So clearly a sign that is both helping HBO Max and like getting people to go see it in big screens. I wrote up a piece too saying basically Dune is too big for your TV. So go.
I really like that take. Mm-hmm. I saw it and I was like, oh, that's a very smart take.
But then you watched it on your TV. You ignored everything I said.
Yes,
and just watched it on your TV.
It's smart for everyone who, you know, doesn't want to watch it on their TV. Yeah, I mean, look, I enjoy watching it on my TV. I don't really like going to the theaters in general.
Yeah, yeah. Especially now, if you can't guarantee safety and everything, then and I put that straight up in my argument. But if you're vaccinated and you're masked and you could go to like not a very crowded screening, I do think it is worth it for a movie like Dune. But hey,
the one thing I went to a theater for was Shang-Chi and mm-hmm. I had a mask on the whole time. It was not the mm-hmm. most comfortable.
Oh yeah. And I'm double masked in the theater. Like I'm just like not even taking sips of water. I'm just like there just to see a movie. But yeah,
anyway,
it's very exciting.
Such good news for Dune.
Let's move on to what we've been working on, and I just want to shout out the Facebook Connect is happening, so keep an eye out for news around that. We're actually 2 hours away from the start of the show, like right now as we're recording, so things are going to happen. I have some news like in the hopper about Facebook's like vision for the metaverse, so you can expect to see all that over in Gadget. And the rumor was that Facebook may end up changing its name to kind of more reflect this focus on the metaverse. So I have no clue. I don't know what's up.
Meta.
You know, by the time you hear this podcast, they will probably have announced something. But still, shoot us your suggestions of what you'd rather Facebook call themselves. There's so
Play-Doh.
Many.
I don't know.
Face Mash.
Ooh, that would be too close to Face Mask.
I think the thing was My Face.
Oh,
My
no.
Face
yeah, I think people
would have
were
been
saying that.
Would have actually been perfect. Yeah,
there were a lot of people already accidentally calling that My Face in my day. Yes,
My Face
back in my day.
Exactly, exactly.
So that's what you're working on.
What have you been working on, Trillin? Yeah,
I am working on taking a break. I want to clear whatever I have left. Next week I'm on off, so you won't hear me on the Engadget podcast. You heard it here first. I just announced it.
That completely ruins my plans and everything. Thank you, Sherman. Please, go
on. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I didn't give you the heads up before this live broadcast. But taking
it's
time
fine.
Off
Take
next
your
week.
Time off. Everybody, yes. Take your time off. If you've been working hard and you have been banking days off,
yeah,
take
the time off. I need to take all of the vacation days, or they're not going to
take
go
your vacation
unused.
Days. Just call in sick, you know, just like skip off your work. No one's going to know.
Yes, no one's going to. But before that, I was working on the multiple embargoes that Google and Apple decided to drop on the same day and all that stuff. So I'll be coming back to more of the same. I've already got some meetings lined up for when I come back. It'll be great. Mm-hmm. I would like to say I'll miss y'all, but I won't. So
there you go. Okay. Appreciate it. Let's move on to our pop culture picks. What do you got this week, Sherlyn?
All right. So I don't know if you, I'm sure you've heard of this show. I'm not sure if you've seen it. This time around, I picked up a new TV series called Only Murders in the Building.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to watching that. Yeah.
Really good. Surprising. I mean, not surprisingly, I knew it was going to be good. So this is a series starring Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Selena Gomez as three neighbors in this ritzy building in Manhattan. I think Upper West Side, if not Upper mm-hmm. East.
Very different culturally there. Let's just say, but yeah,
very different culturally from the rest of this is firmly like glitzy Gossip Girl territory almost.
Sure.
But featuring a cast from all like different walks of life. I will say, like, not everybody in this show is affluent, right? I think at some point they go out to Long Island, like the not great parts of Long Island, not the Hamptons or whatever. So anyway, someone in their building gets murdered. And they're true crime podcast fans, all three of them. And that's how they bond. And they decide.
It's Steve Martin and Martin Short doing a podcast as a TV
it's
show.
Amazing.
Like, I would watch
that premise alone, right? And Steve Martin is so good in this. I mean, Martin Short is Martin Short mm-hmm. is like always Martin Short. Like, Steve mm-hmm. Martin is like, to me, really, really good in this. I was just surprised. His physical comedy on this is also great. Anyway, they make a true crime podcast about it, and it's awesome, and they try to find out what happens. And my favorite part, though, is like Tina Fey and Jane Lynch both guest star. Mm-hmm. And they're so great. They're both incredible. Sting also guest stars, but Sting's like, Sting's guest starred on a bunch of things, I think, that I'm not.
Does he just walk on shirtless like in Dune? I guess not. It was a whole thing.
On the original
in the
80s Dune, right?
Dune,
I was like, anyway, he's not shirtless. I don't think. No, he's not. Anyway.
He's probably a little too old for that right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's on there. I don't think you're ever too old to be shirtless, but he just didn't do that. Anyway, good show. Great, like, great pacing. Amy Ryan does a great job as well. So just so many good actors. I love seeing Martin Short and Steve Martin do their thing. Selena Gomez is also, a really strong actor. So yeah, enjoy this upbeat, not really that upbeat, but upbeat TV series. Can't wait for season two.
Very cool. One thing I want to just highlight is that, hey, the Cowboy Bebop trailer is here for the Netflix live action adaptation of Cowboy Bebop, starring John Cho, Daniela Pineda, Mustafa Shakir. I love Cowboy Bebop.
And a corgi, it looks like.
Oh my God, Sherlyn, you're not even ready for this if you don't know the corgi. But yeah, I love Cowboy Bebop, the show, so much. The anime is on Netflix right now too. Everybody can go watch. You should just watch it, Sherlyn. But yeah, Cowboy Bebop was one of those shows that really, it came like well into like when I was watching anime and was a serious like anime file, but mm-hmm. I certainly have made a lot of friends around that show. I love the character so much. I love the music by Yoko Kanno. Like Cowboy Bebop, I have listened to those soundtracks. I've watched that show enough that it is like embedded in my DNA. So I love Cowboy Bebop, and I've seen a lot of the preview stuff that they've been showing for the show, and it seemed a little weird. You know, there's a lot of stuff. They had this like really cool cartoony preview a couple of weeks ago. I don't think it looked that great. It seemed like a little too weird and cartoony. I like the cast, but trying to do something. Cowboy Bebop is one of those things that's just like perfect. It is a perfect show. Incredible writing, characters, the way it looks, the way it feels. great music. I don't know what an adaptation can add, but I will say, looking at the first trailer for this that Netflix dropped this week, I think it looks kind of interesting. I think it looks cool because it's like combining the aesthetic of anime and an animated show without looking completely cheap, I'd say. Like, it's almost like giving me some of the vibes of like what the Wachowskis did with Speed Racer, which is a great movie, a great, great movie that didn't really like get its due during its time. So I love the aesthetic of this. The actors look good. John Cho looks like he is just like kicking ass as Spike Spiegel. Certainly an older version of Spike, but maybe that's going to be like written to the character. Everybody else, like Daniela Pineda, like is really, really like living that Faye Valentine life. I love what Mustafa Shakir is bringing to this. All I have to say is please don't suck. But also, there's going to be new music from Yoko Kanno for this series. So if anything, we get new stuff, and I think she's a genius composer, not just for anime, but she's done some video game stuff and some solo stuff. So more Cowboy Bebop jazzy music from her, I think, is fantastic. So check out this trailer, and I'll stay tuned. Stay tuned for our thoughts on this once it premieres.
It's you mentioned November 19th. The Wachowskis. Mm-hmm. Sorry, and I just had to, as an aside, be like, I've been rewatching Sense 8. It's just so good, too. So anyway,
Sense 8's so good. Sense8 is so good.
When I need a good cry, I just go to that. Yeah.
And maybe a good thing to watch like as we get up to The Matrix Resurrections, which is still coming this year. Very exciting. I love them so much.
I'm still very bummed. If anyone powerful at Netflix somehow listens to us, I don't know, bring them back. Let them finish a third season the way they want to.
They're busy. They're both
involved in so many other things.
Half of the team is no longer like making movies and stuff. They're doing like plays.
So, and the budget was insane on that show. Like, I get it because they were like shooting in so many locations. But
watch Sensei, everybody. So watch also Cloud Atlas, which I think evokes like a very similar sensibility.
Hey, Duna's on that too.
Yep. Prepare for that. The other thing I want to shout out is a show on HBO Max called The Other Two. And this is it's a comedy series about a young, like Justin Bieber, like pop star. Right. and his like useless siblings. So he has an older sister and an older brother, a failed actor and a failed dancer living in New York. And this is a really funny show about them, like trying to basically deal with their 13-year-old brothers like worldwide pop star success while also being failures in their own right. I think it's really funny. I love the cast. This is a show that has Ken Marino in it, who I think is great in everything. Wanda Sykes, Molly Shannon, people I love to see in shows. And it's also like just genuinely funny. Like, it is laugh out loud funny at times. Very specific in its humor. I'd say, like, if you're a very online person, a very online Twitter person, you'll probably understand the love of what they're doing in the show. The show goes over also, like, being a young gay man in New York and showing, like, the reality of what that is, too, because the brother in the situation is gay. It just, like, kind of does a lot. And it's also, like, just weirdly specific. One, like, running joke in the show is that because the younger brother gets so famous, they end up staying in Justin Theroux's apartment in New York. And there's like, for New Yorkers, there's a whole like level of like, I don't know, legend. There's like legendary stuff about Justin Theroux and how he and his bros hang out in New York and like have wild nights. So you have to be a very specific kind of like New Yorker and online person to kind of even get like why that's hilarious. I think it's really funny overall. The show is really good. And I think everybody should check it out. Yeah, I think you'll enjoy it, Sherlyn. So it is one of those shows that doesn't really get promoted much, but it's right there on HBO Max. So if you want like a fun comedy that also like is meaningful and has great characters, check out The Other Two.
Well, that's it for the episode, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, where I'm talking about movies and Dune and all that fun stuff, and at the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me some great examples of true crime podcasts, I'm at Sherlyn Low on Twitter. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.
Do your hentai research elsewhere.